If you see something, say something.
In a sense, that's the intent of this podcast. But what I'm saying comes too late to make a difference for Larice and Ben, or any of his other victims. The admission includes acknowledging something that stuck with me from the day I heard the dreadful news about her and what my friend Ben did to her and himself in June of 2019, and well before that time to other people.
There were many red flags, but no one wanted to address it because people were afraid of getting them in trouble, or they just could not believe that's what they were seeing. So they just kind of like swept it underneath the rug, or they enabled the behavior.
That's Tracy Daniels, someone I met before this tragedy. He is a master level practitioner at BayCare Behavioral Health in Clearwater, Florida, with a particularly insightful view of sexual assault victims. For example, PTSD, stress-related afflictions. He's familiar with what happened, given that Tracy practices in the vicinity. I felt it was important to delve deeper into the proverbial see something, say something mantra that probably gets tuned out or plays in the recesses of our minds until we notice something too unsettling to not think twice.
So one of the key factors is that if you know something, and we hear this all the time, you have to say something. But see, we get caught up on the fact of the person's title. So they're this, they're that. We're not going to say this. We're not going to say that. No, we have to sound the alarm when we see those things going on. That's one of the biggest factors too, when you have somebody that has mental health who knows how to play the game, because people are not going to think that's what's going on. They're not seeing it, and they don't want to address it.
And we want to accept explanations that we even hold up. We're just looking for that. And we have feelings, too, of if it's that bad, somebody else will know. Somebody in a position of authority will do something.
Exactly. And that's where it now looks as everything is okay, because people have been afraid to address them with it. So now it becomes a learned behavior. And then they start operating in these behaviors that people are not really watching, but people are also covering it up because they're saying that's just the way he is. That's just, oh, it's okay, because you know what? And it's not okay. It is not okay. When we're talking about mental health issues, that's what makes it very big, really, is crying out for help. However, we don't really know how to help them, because see it as that's just the way that they are. They've always been like that. You know, this situation's happened before and they've gotten over it. They've come through it. So you know what? They're better. But no, they have built up a style of living, their defense mechanism that they're living behind to continue to do the things that they're doing.
Shannon Sokolowski has worked in the field of victim advocacy in Florida for the past 20 years. Extensively with survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault.
Domestic violence at its foundation is about attitudes and belief systems that you're entitled to certain things in your relationship. And attitudes and beliefs are not illegal. So by the time formal systems are involved, it's often pretty late in the game. Lots of other things have happened by the time that takes place. And so I think what's really, really helpful is to challenge those attitudes and belief systems as early as possible.
Over the past decade and continuing today, Shannon has served as executive director of a state-certified domestic violence center and rape crisis program here in Florida. In addition, she has served on two local domestic violence fatality review teams and is currently doing this at the state level. These types of efforts focus on examining domestic violence fatalities, essentially to glean from them potential ways to better support victims and survivors in the future.
So one of the interventions that has been pretty effective, some primary prevention initiatives that a lot of victim service organizations and others are using, is going into middle schools and high schools and youth athletic entities and doing presentations to build healthy attitudes and belief systems early on, so that hopefully it never even forms with this kind of entitled sensibility and they have healthy outlooks on relationships from the start before they begin. I think if they've already begun and the attitudes and belief systems are there, then we're looking to really healthy individuals, and in particular healthy men, to confront men in their lives might not even know about the violence, but they make a sexist joke or they say a disparaging comment about women, you know, even if it's in jest, or they just seem to have a general disrespectful attitude towards women or not a very equitable outlook or viewpoint on relationships. And to be able to confront those attitudes, to be able to say, you know, hey, man, that joke really wasn't that funny. You know, I just didn't really find it that funny. Why would you say something like that? To be able to confront those attitudes from a person who is a friend, who has a closeness, who can have that confrontation in a loving, supportive way. You know, I think about women in my life like this, right? And can help to kind of challenge those attitudes and belief systems early on. Can be very, very, very helpful, because if you can interrupt that early, the hope is it never does go all the way down through the continuum where they're actually now using violence and reinforcing those attitudes and belief systems in those other ways. So I think men have a critical role to play in the movement to end violence against women by confronting those attitudes and belief systems and holding friends accountable themselves, because you can say, hey, if you're going to treat people like that, you're not going to be my friend. You're not going to be in my life. I'm not going golfing with you. I'm not going to be hanging out with you if you're going to be that way in your relationships.
Yeah, my friend moved in with the woman he killed 6 months before this happened. And when he did move in with her, I said, you don't really love her. You're doing this as you need a place to live. He was living in the back of his office. That's one of the craziest things is he was allowed to continue practicing.
And then again, you know, just to reiterate for those systems, I know you had a lot of trust that they would know what was happening. But again, there's not a lot of domestic violence training happening in a lot of these professional systems. Even in field of medicine can be, again, that 2 hours of domestic violence training every 6 years. So if we could have increased domestic violence training for substance abuse and as substance use professionals, for medical professionals, for licensed therapists and clinicians, that would be very, very helpful so that they would be equipped to identify these warning signs and red flags early and not be manipulated or coerced by perpetrators who are very, very charming and can explain their behavior away very easily.
After I became aware of Dr. First's more worrisome behaviors, including overdosing on nitrous oxide, I shared some of these mounting concerns with my long-term business partner, Lynette. I was looking to get the reality off my chest, to talk about my belief that the Florida Medical Board's dental profession authorities must have had awareness because of Ben's participation in the state's program for impaired physicians. I had doubts about whether they were going to do anything, but isn't that their responsibility? As Lynette explained, she strongly considered taking action herself.
Before I pursued a career in public relations, I had considered a career in dentistry. And so I worked for a couple of different dentists as I was going to college to get a feel for whether this was something I wanted to pursue or not. So I was familiar with, in particularly, oral surgeons. I worked for an oral surgeon. So I was familiar with his practice and what it was involved, you know, putting people, air quote, to sleep so that they could have procedures performed comfortably. And when I learned that Ben was abusing drugs, it became very concerning to me, because how could he possibly accurately, carefully, effectively care for his patients if he was not completely sober? I tried to mind my business, so to speak, with that. But as things progressed with him, it reached a point where I had considered contacting not police, but, and forgive me, I'm not sure what it would be, like the Medical Association.
Medical Board of Florida probably was what led that direction.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to go, because I thought that they would be in best position to take action and review, or, you know, his license or possibly suspend it.
You must have felt conflicted with this awareness. Where is this going? How to help? And I think that was evident to you. I was trying to help him.
Oh, for sure. And you're the reason I did not go to the medical board, because I felt that you were trying to help him, and that I wouldn't say that you had a handle on it, but you were with him, counseling him and encouraging him to do things that were in his best interest.
Yeah, and at the same time, blinded, you know, by it. And there was trouble lurking, and I always feared he would just off himself and not take another person with him. And that is what disturbed me the most, that we, meaning collectively, those directly and indirectly having knowledge, it could have done something to change the trajectory of his life, to essentially remove him one way or another from practicing oral surgery and putting others' lives at risk. And he had people who had serious health ailments and maybe shouldn't have been operated on. For example, somebody went into cardiac arrest who was a at-risk patient, and Ben was, I think, pretty desperate for money. And so he might do things that other people wouldn't.
Our system, you know, it's there to help us. Not every doctor is corrupt. They're not, you know. And so now we don't want to, you know, give in to say, oh, we don't want to trust anybody. No, we want to. However, if there's things that you feel that need to be addressed, they have to be addressed. Because I always tell people, listen, when you go to see a doctor, no matter who it is, evaluate them like they're evaluating you. This is a relationship that you both are in. And so you got to be able to address these things, and you want to ask questions to them. Because if you ask questions and you notice that they're now kind of beginning to become a little snide or flippant with you, or they're now trying to address you in a way because they seem superior and you're not, then you need to get up and leave, because it's your insurance that's paying them. You're the one that's providing finances for them. And so if I can't have a conversation with you and ask you, how long have you been practicing and how many cases have you handled? Have you ever had any misconduct cases against you? Have you had anything? And if they can't get into that, then guess what? It's time for me to get up and leave, because you don't want to be honest with me. Plus, you want to seem as if I'm doing something wrong to you. And that's not true, because my insurance, my money is what's paying you. And so I tell people that all the time. Evaluate them just like you've been evaluated.
Ironically, Larice, who was Ben's final victim, the woman he murdered, suggested to her daughter, Jess, to see Dr. First for a procedure consultation. Larice had a successful experience with him for another surgery years prior, which she told me about shortly after Ben introduced us in December 2018, 6 months before he took her life and his. Here's Larice's daughter, Jess, describing that initial experience with Dr. First, along with her mother.
All four of my teeth were impacted, but when there was a hole in my tooth, I guess, when it was pulled, and it was going to leave something with my sinuses, and he took the x-rays, and he was the only one out of everyone who said something about it. He was the only one who showed it to us, and he's like, there it is, right there. Like, you know, this is what we're going to do too for her. And so we just felt very comfortable.
Ben's expertise and reassuring demeanor as a surgeon impressed many people. He was gifted, able to envision and do at times what other maxillofacial surgeons couldn't. His mother recounts this example with a family friend.
He had to have teeth extracted in the back of his mouth, and he was told that he would have to have a removable bridge because there was no way to attach the teeth to do the implants, because his bone was too weak, and at his age it couldn't be done, and whatever. And he went to several different dentists or oral surgeons, and none of them could do the work. And I was telling Ben, and Ben said, tell him to come up and let me see him. Let me look at him. So they drove, they lived in Naples, and they drove up to his office in Newport Richey. And he looked at him and he said, I can do it. He said, I can take the bone, the marrow from your shin bone, and put it in your mouth, and you'll grow fresh bone. Maybe I'm simplifying it too much, but that was kind of it. And he did the surgery on him, and Norman still has the teeth. He did the surgery, he had to wait, he did the implants, and he has the teeth, and it's not removable.
And what was the reaction of who he went to originally?
Oh, his dentist couldn't believe that this could be done. He said, I can't believe it. I've never seen this before. Now, possibly he was a lot older than Ben, and this is more modern medicine. I don't know. But Ben was excellent at what he did.
And Larice's daughter, Jess, concurs.
I thought he did a good job. I thought his staff was really nice. Her and I were sitting on the couch and we saw some of those reviews before I was about to leave that day. And I was like, oh my gosh, Mom, this kind of makes me nervous. And she's like, oh, don't worry about it. It's fine. And then she wrote a really nice review about him. Because that's the type of person she was. She was going to protect somebody, and she even helped him a lot with his boards, like studying when he needed to recertify. She helped him study, like read the book to him, sat there with him, kept him company. She was very much somebody who was going to help.
If that was something you saw, what would you say, do, or report? If you did, say something, do something.
Ben's son, Jared, considered turning his own father in, knowing what he knew about his dad, including how careless he was about hiding his transgressions, addictions, and habits.
Even as, like, 14, 15, a lot of things weren't adding up. Like, I was wondering how he was still safely practicing with him being gone to rehab and doing all this stuff. And then I was also wondering how he's cooking his books, because the DEA don't play with certain drug uses. Yeah, I mean, certain stocks of drugs being depleted at odd levels. I mean, he was doing his own stuff, and I don't know how he got away with that for so long. I mean, if I wanted to, I very well could have turned him in for a multitude of things. I wasn't really interested in that, though.
Jared's mother, who stayed married to Ben for 17 years, speaks to a different side of the equation.
If he had had like any lawsuits that were hanging over him because he damaged someone to not repair or kill someone under practice, then I think that the Board of Medicine will get involved. But even if you call, you know, you have to look at it the way that the system is. There's so many patients that you have. Every doctor has lawsuits from people that want to take advantage of the system. If everybody picked up the phone and said, you know, to the board to stop someone from working, nobody would be working. Because, you know, there's people that intentionally go to doctors to try to sue them. And so because they know that they're not going to fight the whole thing and the insurance is going to settle it and they're going to get money. So doctors get sued left and right. Ben was never a bad doctor.
Was he willing to get help? And then what did help look like for him? And that may have been the very thing that he was rejecting, because he had things going on with him that, yes, slipped through the cracks. However, how do we still see him as a human? Because that's what he is.
So how can we help government, law enforcement, and the legal system seal up some of these cracks, patch these cracks? Life and death is involved. Do it for Larice. Do it for the next Larice. Do it for the families of those affected, those that came before Larice who were abused. Say something. Do something.
Seeing something actually did result in others speaking up in what should have been more than ample time, time to make a difference.
Imagine being Ben's mother. She saw something. Ben not only said something, but did something that was particularly courageous, specifically in 2003.
Did an intervention.
Mary would call me in the middle of the night at times to tell me that he wasn't home, that she would drive past the office and his car was there, and that she was sure that he was taking the gas, and called again, and she said that the staff was banging on the door and no one answered the door, and that Ben's car was there. And I suggested that she call the police, and she said, I can't do that. I don't want to call the police. I don't want it in the newspapers, which I kind of can understand. And she said, do you know anybody that you can call? And I got the name of someone who was, I don't know what you call him, an interventionist. I don't know what the term is. And Don and I paid him, and he went, and I guess he broke into the office. No one let him into the office. I don't think Mary had a key to it. And he dragged him out and took him to rehab. And Ben was hooked up to gas, and I guess he was out of it. And this gentleman, I don't remember his name, came and took him to rehab. And that's when Ben stopped speaking to us.
So many broken hearts. Hear from that of Larice's mother, Lenore.
It's very different. Nothing means the same. You know, we live in a society that's very materialistic, and you know what our society is. And it does, nothing means anything but family and people you love.
Yeah.
And I learned it a long time ago because my parents died young. But when you lose your daughter, I keep going just to, because I can't stop, because I don't want to go down a rabbit hole.
What calls out louder than ever in hindsight are the breakdowns that led to the condo Larissa's mother owned, where Larissa and Ben resided, and the door officers decided not to break down.
I just think that it's important that we continue to have conversations around what we're having right now, you know, and being able to address it in the right vein. Because when you look at this, and I can speak from it, I'm dealing with 911 dispatchers, to be truthful, their job is really, really difficult because they're listening to this and they have to make a picture out of what's being said.
Sheriff Quattieri declined to respond through his communication staff, whether in a written statement or recorded interview. Though one of the sheriff's investigating officers got the impression a person may have been peeking out the peephole.
If the sheriff sees the report, he should say something about it. The public deserves some answers.
Symptoms of mental illness, drug abuse, sex addiction, violent behavior, delusion, whatever and wherever these traits surface, what could be done and too often isn't.
The most important part out of all of this is being able to connect the right structures so that we're going to get the right help that's going to make a difference. And to me, those are the biggest things when we see these kind of situations, because, you know, you look at how things break down and things do break down. You know, what was in the mindset of what was taking place? Because once again, it could have been like what we're talking about. They could have seen, okay, this is a doctor. And so, you know, we don't want to pass judgment. So, I don't know if that was their thought. I'm not saying it.
When you think you know someone, you may want to think again and not trust all of your instincts. I don't want to support any sort of outbreak of paranoia, but we all probably need an extra dose of awareness when the quiet little voice inside us says, you can ignore this. Somebody else should take care of it. Processes, programs, and protocols I learned through researching this podcast cannot take the place of people taking action for the sake of your friends, loved ones, and even doctors so broken they shouldn't even be near a scalpel, pistol, or pocket knife, let alone another woman's neck to strangle, face to beat, or emotions to choke out. My friend Ben did it all, and it took a terrible toll.
The question remains, who should pay it? Which agency in the state of Florida, frankly everywhere in the country, is going to be accountable for letting impaired practitioners do way too much in the light of day?
Or court systems dimming under plea deals and law enforcement doing way too little in the dark of night, choosing to write their findings in a report that never got the attention it deserved. Pinellas County officers returned the next day in response to family demands for a wellness check. And they ended up writing a much more detailed report about the death of Larissa at the hands of Dr. Ben First. Before my friend pulled the trigger on his own demise. None of this means that Ben gets the last word on what transpired. We can be silent or choose to say something. You've heard what happened. Say something. Join me in doing something.